It's KNPR's State of Nevada. I'm Dave Becker. That bathtub ring around Lake Mead is not the only marker reminding us of the ongoing and potentially catastrophic drought conditions in the West and how climate change continues to impact our resources. The extreme heat and drought have already become a threat to life in the Southwest. Abandoned pet tortoises here have been unable to find water. Farmed salmon are being carted to the ocean in trucks since the rivers and streams are too shallow and sometimes too warm to carry them along. Recently, the Bureau of Land Management sent a letter to ranchers stating the obvious. If current drought conditions continue, grazing on federal land may come to an end. So how will the drought affect humans living in the Southwest? And is there a point at which the region will become uninhabitable? Or will we have to make drastic changes to protect our water supply? Joining us to start the discussion on this ongoing drought and what we can do is Eric Holthaus. He's a meteorologist who writes about the effects of climate change for Slate. Eric, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
I mentioned some scary facts about the drought in the introduction, but we were also taken aback a little bit by the title of one of your more recent Slate pieces called Thirsty West, Why Californians Will Soon Be Drinking Their Own Pee. You say this is more cost effective than desalination. Tell us about the process of recycling water in this way.
Well, Las Vegas already does that. They recycle sewer water for use in irrigation. So that's for watering lawns and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I guess the point that I'm trying to make in the article is that it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense to have lawns in the first place in a place like Las Vegas that gets only 4 inches of rain a year. And we'd be probably better served by just finishing out that process and purifying the wastewater back to drinking water standards, so we can limit the intake from Lake Mead.
Okay, so as we do that, though, tell us about this method of working with the sewer water versus desalination. Pros of recycled cost, but what about how likely the public is to embrace this source of water? I mean, bad PR, right?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's obviously headwinds there when you tell people that we're just gonna, you know, like, pump sewer water into your morning teeth brushing routine. But I think it's kind of funny how there's been a lot of backlash, even though it's much cheaper. So the two examples I gave in the piece were there's a new plant being built in San Diego, desalination plant. It's been about 10 years in the making and it's cost over $1 billion. And they're only going to be able to supply 7% of the county's water needs that way. And just up the coast in Orange County, they have they're underway expanding a water recycling facility to turn wastewater into drinking water. And they're going to be able to produce almost twice the amount of water for a third of the average cost. Mm-hmm. So it's much better for the environment. It's much more energy efficient, and you're going to get more water in the end that way because it's going to be cheaper for people's bills.
We're also joined by author and conservationist William DeBise. William, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's nice to be
with you. So what do you think of Eric Holthaus's assessment? What extreme measures will cities in the very near future likely have to take to maintain water supplies?
You know, I didn't have any audio from you all for the last few minutes, so I don't know what Eric said. Could you summarize it?
Well, in a nutshell, there's a headwind for recycling wastewater, but at the same time, wastewater recycling is much, much cheaper than desalination. I guess looking at those options, which seem to be the two main options, at least on the west coast of the U.S., what extreme measures will cities likely have to take to maintain water supplies beyond that?
Well, it's going to come to pretty big crunches. I think the most widespread measure is probably going to be for the cities that are connected by virtue of big plumbing to agricultural districts, that we're going to be seeing large transfers of water from agriculture to urban and industrial uses. As Eric evidently said, the kinds of adaptations that involve using recycling wastewater and so forth, those are going to be pursued with the pedal to the metal. But even they are not going to solve the problems that we're going to going to see, we're going to have to move a lot of water from ag to cities.
Hmm. And it's William Dubuis, by the way. My apologies for that. Eric Holthaus, you have also written about how farmers in California are adapting, in some cases, not with high-tech solutions, but rather by returning to ancient methods. Tell us about the process of dry farming. How does it work? Eric, are you?
Yeah,
there we go. Okay, you're on.
I'm here. Mm-hmm. It's really kind of a niche, and the couple of farmers that I talked to think that it always will be, just because they're so much invested in using irrigation and using in industrial scale agriculture in the Central Valley that only in a certain few climates is dry farming even possible, and it already gets way too hot in the Central Valley where most of California agriculture is for this method to work well. But essentially, what they do is they don't irrigate at all, and they have a deep bed of topsoil that they use to retain soil moisture throughout the dry season. So, and this is used to be how most agriculture was practiced in California along the coast. But people have kind of gotten away from that in the last couple decades.
Mm-hmm. So, Eric Holthaus, what cities are getting it right from a planning perspective? Who's doing it well?
Well, I think that there's a lot of good things going on in Las Vegas. As much as I've criticized them, that they are, it seems like they're finally abandoning, under great pressure, the idea of additional interbasin transfer from the groundwater in other parts of the state, and instead focusing on more efficiency at home, where they're paying people to get rid of lawns, which is the number one use of water in Las Vegas is people growing grass.
Yeah. Now I was going to say, you have said that Las Vegas doesn't conserve as much water as it says it does. And actually, not too long ago, we had Water Commissioner John Ensminger on from the Southern Nevada Water Authority, and he had this to say about water use in Las Vegas.
If you use the same methodology for our water use that the LA Times used for Los Angeles' water use, ours is actually quite a bit less than Los Angeles. And the same would be said for Tucson, for Phoenix, because they're not including in those numbers their irrigated outdoor areas, including golf courses.
Now, he said per capita use is not as bad as reported by the LA Times and in some of your articles. What do you make of his assessment?
Well, I trust him if he has run the numbers himself. I was reporting... I was reporting those publicly available numbers as they were. So I still think that Las Vegas is right at the top of their goal by 2030 is to get down to the standard where the state of California is already right now as an average. So it doesn't seem to me to be that ambitious of a goal of reducing water usage per capita in the city.
We're joined now by Tom Piotta, Vice President for Research at UNLV and climate change expert. Tom, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here.
You've told us on this program that the key for cities adapting is to develop smart technologies. And beyond those that we have already discussed, what emerging technologies will help cities and individuals adapt?
Sure. So, yeah, smart technologies include a lot of different things, whether those are the ways that we reduce water that we use both indoor and outdoor. And that impacts individuals by themselves, but it's also the larger infrastructure side of things too, in terms of how water is used and how water is reused and recycled. Also, as was noted. So technology advances may be part of this. As was noted earlier, conservation is going to be a key to all of this, and how we reuse technologies too. But a lot of the key to all those is how technologies play into the further development and how we continue to push those sides of the equation also, and the development of those technologies. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of this. And a big part of this is in Las Vegas is Las Vegas is continuing to recycle their water. We should note that when we take our showers, when we flush our toilets, all that water goes down the sewer pipe, goes out to Las Vegas Wash, and goes out to Lake Mead. That's where we get our water from. So from one standpoint, we recycle all of our water. It goes back out to Lake Mead, and that's where we get our water from. So there's mm-hmm. a very tight loop that we're connected with our water supply and in the way we reuse that also.
Mm-hmm. Would you take issue with Eric Holthaus's writing in Slate some time back that Las Vegas is not doing everything it could?
I think Las Vegas has come a long way. I mean, there was a time back, you know, whether it was 10, 20 years ago, where the development of Las Vegas wasn't so conservation oriented. That's come a long way. If we go and look the way new developments occur now, and we look around how much turf is occurring, there's not that much turf. The ability mm-hmm. to remove grass and the incentive programs that have put into place, that's dramatically reduced now in the amount of water that's being used for outdoor water use. And that's the biggest water use in Las Vegas right now mm-hmm. is the outdoor portion of it.
On the other hand, have we come far enough? I mean, part of Eric Holthaus's Slate article was that we could do a lot more.
Right. There's always the ability to continue to do more. And I think that's the emphasis that's being placed here is – look, there's not going to be one silver bullet to solving our water problems. It's going to be about continuing to conserve. It's going to be continuing to look for additional ways to work on getting additional water supplies, whether that's through working with other entities within the basin, whether that's through diversification of water supplies, whether that's through desalinization in other areas. So I think you have to look at all those different options in terms of how you solve the water issues of the region.
Mm-hmm. Eric Holthaus, you wrote that Las Vegas needed to be more ambitious in its water conservation efforts. How so?
Well, I think that there is, like we've been saying, mm-hmm. there is grass that is still the number one water use in the city, and it just seems to me that, you know, when you get outside the city limits, there's not a whole lot of grass growing naturally.
So should we do things like outlaw grass, or, you know, grandfather it in, say from this point forward no more grass can be added to the valley? I mean, steps like that?
I think that you don't want to be too heavy-handed about it, but at the same time there's a very real situation in that you can't continue on the current path. So you know, maybe increasing the incentive to remove lawn. I mean, the water district pays to have people remove grass now. So and that will help everyone. You know, each square foot of grass that's removed will be a bit of evaporation that won't be lost.
We're also joined in this conversation by Steve Ripka, who is the president of Green Dream. Steve Ripka, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So how do you incentivize the kinds of conservation efforts that Eric Holthaus is talking about for individuals?
There's a term that I like to use called pay the truth, and it applies to a lot of issues, not just water conservation. But currently, we don't value water as the life-giving source of almost everything that we depend on properly. And so if we'd simply raised our rates for people who use an excess of water, significantly raise our rates, I think that would go a long ways to promoting conservation in a fair and equitable manner. Everybody needs access to inexpensive water for their basic needs, and I think that should always be the case. But for people that waste it on a tremendous level, and there's plenty of those here in Southern Nevada, they're not paying their fair share. Hmm. And if it hurt them financially, I think they'd change.
In the last conversation we had with John Ensminger of Southern Nevada Water Authority, I got to a point where I asked him, why is it that this area, 4 inches of rainfall a year, has some of the cheapest municipal water rates of any big city in the country? And he said, well, those are the actual costs. I mean, is that idea of just covering the actual costs something that we need to rethink from what you're saying about pay the truth?
I don't think that that's the way we should look at it. The way we use water in Southern Nevada was the equivalent of going to Scotland with an army of people with electric hair dryers to create an off-road desert motorcycle race. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to have golf courses and large areas of grass or even ornamental plants when there are really important issues that we need to look at going into the future. And one of them that ties right into it is food scarcity or abundance in the local environment. And I think we need to localize our economy, localize our food production. We need to look at things like permaculture and really start to educate the public about the benefits of these things going forward.
So would you do things like, say, outlaw golf courses?
Well, again, I don't think you should outlaw. I don't think you can legislate correct action, but I do think that our economic system provides a lot of disincentives for right action. I think that if we, again, pay the truth for a lot of things that we do, and we have to look forward and figure out what's the cost of these actions that we're currently taking and where is it leading us? We're like somebody who got a brand new pair of tennis shoes and we're so excited, we're running down the road and before we know it, we're in this dead-end canyon, but we're looking at our shoes and we're not looking up ahead at what's coming. We need to raise our heads, look at what's happening with the climate, the drought. These are signs of what's coming and it's only going to get worse. So we have to take proactive approach to solutions, and there are plenty out there. We just need to start the process and accelerate it.
We are talking about the drought in the American Southwest and about climate change and the potentially cataclysmic things that might happen if the drought continues. And if you are concerned about dwindling resources, we'd like to hear from you. You can drop us a line online at knprnews.org. That's knprnews.org. And tell us what you make of this conversation and its implications. William DeBuis, you took an in-depth look at Phoenix and the perils it faces from climate change. And in fact, you say a time is coming where the only solution is going to be to leave that city. Where, in your opinion, did city planners for the Phoenix area go wrong?
Well, Phoenix is in a very, very delicate situation. It's not next to Lake Mead like as Las Vegas is. And Las Vegas, as you know, is building basically a bathtub drain at the bottom of Lake Mead, the so-called intake number 3. And Phoenix is also not next to the ocean where desalination is possible. And even more, the Central Arizona Project, on which it depends for a lot of its water, has junior water rights to all of California's water rights. So that when cutbacks come on deliveries out of Lake Mead, Arizona, and especially the CAP, will have to absorb not only its pro rata share, but also California's share of the cutbacks. So the prognosis for Central Arizona is just simply not good. And in a way, you could look back and say the big error back in the 60s was actually authorizing and building the CAP in the first place, because the availability of that water lured in and fueled development that's simply not sustainable.
Mm-hmm. So is the prognosis any better for Las Vegas?
Yeah, a little bit better. Not a lot, but a little bit better, because even if Lake Mead fails, even if Lake Mead drops to a level where you can't get water through the dam, Las Vegas is still there with its bathtub drain, being able to pull water out of the lake. The only other thing I would say is, you know, I don't want to diss conservation. It's very important. It's morally right. It's a good thing all around. But the truth of the matter is that in most U.S. cities, when water is conserved, you have to think about where that conserved water goes. In most cities, it goes to the next housing development or strip mall down the road. And this just creates more stress and less flexibility in resources. It's a phenomenon called demand hardening. And in a kind of counterintuitive way, in times of drought, waste is your best friend because it's easy to cut back on waste. But when everybody has conserved and is only using the water they absolutely need, and then you have a big drop in supply from climate change, mega drought, whatever it might be, then when you cut back, you're cutting back into truly essential uses. And that's when suffering occurs.
Yeah. Tom Piotta, as you noted, Las Vegas has kind of curbed the industrial sort of growth that it had perhaps a decade or two decades and more ago. Nevertheless, can you envision a future for the Las Vegas Valley where it's essentially an unlivable city?
No, I think it's really a matter of how we grow. And this isn't just Las Vegas unique. I think it's a Southwest region. I mean, if you look at the projections, and Brookings has looked at the projections, the Southwest is going to continue to grow. So it's a matter of how you grow in the Southwest. And it's a particular challenge because you're really overlaying a couple things. You're overlaying already an overtaxed Colorado River Basin, where it's already over-allocated. You're overlaying on that a climate change situation where it's a vulnerable region for reducing water supplies. So really what the challenge for the region, whether it's the Southwest or Las Vegas, is how do you grow in a sustainable way? What's the right way, and what are the solutions that are going to allow you to get there? What are the right ways for, what are the right types of economic development sectors that you grow in that use low amounts of water? Are there needs to shift water use from agricultural to urban areas, and how do you do that using technologies? What are some of the solutions? What are the ways that we diversify our water supplies, whether that's through desalinization? So it's part of a larger system, and I don't think you can look at it in any one isolated way. We're very much an interconnected region, whether we like it or not.
Do you think the technologies are out there?
Yeah, I think they are. I think we're, and it's not just in the water sector. I think we see this in the energy sector too, and they're very much interconnected sectors too.
We are talking about the potentially catastrophic drought conditions in the West. Exceptional drought is the technical descriptor for what's going on in California right now. Lake Mead, of course, the bathtub ring is growing and growing. And extreme heat and drought are being aggravated by climate change as well. We're talking about what's down the road with Tom Piotta, Vice President for Research at UNLV, Steve Ripka, the President of Green Dream, author and conservationist William DeBuise, and Eric Holthaus, a meteorologist who writes for Slate magazine. Tom Piotta, what are Las Vegas planners doing to incorporate greener methods and technologies into the infrastructure?
So I think what you're seeing is you're seeing several things. You're certainly seeing changes in design standards in terms of what the outdoor landscape looks like in terms of when people develop and what they're allowed to plan in terms of turf. You know, that was discussed earlier. I think you're seeing also an assessment, and I'll bring this some back in terms of what are the potential implications of climate change. Everyone's concerned about that. What are the potential vulnerabilities around climate change into infrastructure also? So I think there's a lot of uncertainty around that right now, but I think you're starting to see some of that discussion occurring about what are our vulnerabilities, whether those are around our water supply systems, whether those are around our flood control systems, whether those are around our energy systems, whether those are public health systems too, and starting to make that assessment in terms of, are we vulnerable in certain areas? And those are those things that we can fix, or are we okay, given the uncertainties that climate may bring to us in the next 20 to 50 years?
Now, Tom Piotta, I know you've got a really busy morning, and I understand you've got to depart. So I wanted to say thank you very much for joining us.
I really appreciate having
you here. We were referring to this segment around the office informally as we got it ready as our summer climate change apocalypse show. And, of course, you know, everybody's chuckling a little bit. On the other hand, kind of not, because it's hard not to envision a dire future when we look at the current reality. Eric Holthaus, when it comes to dwindling food resources, dying wildlife, things like that, how bad can it get? Start, if you would, by projecting 20 years in the future based on what we know now.
Okay, so by 2030, here is your daily apocalypse. Then there's really nothing that we can do right now as a planet to change our trajectory for the next 20 years. That's just too short of a timescale for climate change. So we are we're locked in basically from the last 100 years of fossil fuel emissions. Because of the lag time in CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. So So that's kind of set already, that the next 20 years. But what we can change right now is our path for beyond that. So starting by around 2030 or so, we can start to see a divergence in projections, where if we continue on business as usual, there's a good chance we can get up to 3 or 4 degrees Celsius global rise in average temperatures, and that is really that apocalypse scenario where there's places on the earth that agriculture becomes nearly impossible, and we're going to get a lot of movements of people, whether because of a sea level rise or increasing extreme weather events or those sorts of things. But on the other hand, if we do start to take more drastic action than what we have already, we could see a peak in climate change in the next 20 or 30 years. So and that's kind of the best case scenario right now.
Steve Ricka, you're gripped by an even more dire fear, which is to say extinction of the species. And it's the human species, I gather, because mass extinction has been projected as a distinct possibility elsewhere. How likely is that to happen to the human race, and what time frame?
Well, I'm not a scientist, but I follow a lot of different sources of information, including some very credible scientific sources. And there is a growing concern that near-term human extinction is becoming a very real possibility. Now, I'm not saying that that's a consensus among most scientific communities or sources, but there are some credible people out there that are studying the front lines of things like methane releases in the Arctic and other tipping points or positive feedbacks that are starting to kick in, and those are not good things. So the things that Eric is talking about are extremely important, that we start taking this stuff seriously and making the change now and doing it consciously rather than just waiting for it to happen to us, because if we take that approach, it could likely be too late. And we do know that we are currently in the midst of the sixth great extinction event that we're aware of in geological history. And this is the one that has been caused by a species, and that's human beings.
William DeWeese, the notion of that kind of extinction is pretty frightening. I understand we lost William DeWeese, so we are going to try to get him back in just a moment or so. Eric Holthaus, the idea of the sixth extinction event being one where humans are wrapped up right in the middle of everything, it sounds pretty dire. I mean, have you heard that from experts in the field as well, that's certainly a possibility?
I've heard it, but humans are resilient, and I don't think that any serious scientific projection right now is talking about humans going extinct. But definitely we are causing the rapid extinction of other species. And I think that's something, you know, if I was a coast redwood, or if I was, you know, one of the endangered species on the planet right now, I would be getting pretty pissed at humans right now.
Steve Ripka, there was a hearing on climate change and such a little bit earlier this week in the U.S. Senate. A number of former Republican appointees to the Environmental Protection Agency were testifying and talking about some of the things that were happening right now and saying this is where it is. They didn't get a lot of attention in that hearing. People still seem to be ignoring this in some places. Why do you think that is?
We have a culture of convenience. Everyone's focused on inward. There's a lot of entertainment out there. And a lot of people are just struggling to make day-to-day events happen, you know, take care of their families and so forth. And there's so many distractions and so little honest reporting about the real issues that we're facing as a species, as stewards of the planet. It's just not in most people's awareness. And it's very sad commentary on the state of our media, and I applaud you guys for having this show because this type of conversation is really essential to our future.
Eric Holthaus, you write about this for Slate. You know, this is your field. How do you make this real for people who haven't studied it closely, aren't aware of the plethora of evidence, and just don't know what to think about climate change?
Yeah, I think, and I totally agree that this is probably the most important thing that's ever happened to humanity, and that's a very bold statement, but it's true.
The most important thing.
We are single-handedly making our planet uninhabitable for a lot of species, and that comes with consequences. So what I try to do is bring it down to the human personal level as much as possible, and you know, talk to people that are going through on the front lines. You know, whether their home just got destroyed by Hurricane Sandy, or whether they're a farmer in California that's trying to rethink how to do agriculture in a time of climate change. I think when you talk about people that are going through this, that are trying to take that long view into consideration, I think that's something that will resonate a little bit more than just talking about doom and gloom in science.
Steve Ripka?
I have an approach that I like to use of personal responsibility. And I use my own results as an example for others, including using renewable energy and lifestyle changes that have resulted in between 80 and 90% reduction in carbon emissions by our household. So my personal results actually have worked, and it has been a very good financial investment as well. So that's an incentive that people can latch onto.
I want to thank our guest Steve Ripka, president of Green Dream, author and conservationist William DuBois, Eric Holthaus, who's a meteorologist who writes for Slate.com, and Tom Piotta, vice president for research at UNLV. Thank you all very much for being with us.
Thank you.